uncensored, no holds barred talk, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Welcome to another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. This is the Wednesday edition of the broadcast. Wednesday, March the 14th, 2012, into Thursday, March 15th, 2012. Thanks for being with us here tonight. We're going to get into, well, what little news we have to get into. There's almost not a show tonight at all. Lack of material, not very much to get into, so we have a few emails as well. So what I'm going to do is we'll get through emails. We'll get through the little bit of news we have, and then we'll take extra time tonight to read from Zachariah Sitchin's End of Days. We started a new chapter last night, so we'll get deeper into that chapter here for you tonight on the broadcast. Thanks so much for staying up late with us. My website where this broadcast originates from is theglobalreality.com. It's www.theglobalreality.com, and you find everything up there at theglobalreality.com pertaining to my work. You'll find news, daily news that we post up there, the link to listen to the stream. Now, we have a little bumper in there that says, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, streaming news and information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now, that means that there's stuff streaming 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether it's live, whether it's Memorex, regardless of that, there's stuff streaming. Now, that does not mean that I do fucking shows 7 days a week. Nothing pisses me off than some ass clown comes in on like a Saturday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Could be a show, right? You could be a show tonight? There's a show tonight? At 3 o'clock on a Saturday, dude, even fucking charity workers take weekends off. Okay? Sorry. That's all you're getting. I did 4 hours a day for over 2 years and a Saturday show. I said a lot of things in those shows I don't ever, want to have to go back and rehash and repeat, So, that's why I like to, I'll be honest with you, in those shows when I was doing 4 hour shows, I was having to put so much filler in the broadcast and drag stuff out. It was not fun doing a show like that. I thought I had to do it at the time. I thought I needed to do it. I was going up against Alex Jones, and I was giving him a run for his money, He got him pulled off some of his stations. They put my show on instead. But, in the end, it just wasn't worth it because, it may be 4 hours, but if you do the math on how many commercials there are, the show, how much time I was talking is the same amount of time that the shows generally are now, 2 hours, 2.5 hours, whatever. So even when I was doing 4 hour shows, my God, I was wasting 2 hours of my life every day where I wasn't doing anything productive but sitting through commercials. 2 hours a day per show? That's ridiculous. So that's why, I've condensed my shows down some now so that, it's all killer, no filler, as they like to say. My email address, if you'd like to email me anytime or during the show or after the show or any other time, globalrealityshow@gmail.com. That's globalrealityshow@gmail.com. If you ever can't find my email address and you need it, very simple. go to my website, theglobalreality.com, click on the contact tab there, and you can put in a message. It'll send it right to my email. So it's very simple. No excuses if you can't get a hold of me. I've had people, I can't get a hold of you. I don't know how to blah, blah, blah. I'm like, man, I say my email address almost every show. I got a little tab there on my email, on my website that says contact on it. I mean, generally that means contact. You know, that's how you contact them. So there's just no excuses for that. But, you know, I don't know what it is. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink, I guess. Let's see what kind of emails we have here tonight. This is from Anderson. He says, the reconquest is on. Do you have any insight into possible historical archaeological motivations or behind what seems to be the beginning of a war in Africa? What war booty might be had? Ark of the Covenant, etc. Well, I don't believe the Ark of the Covenant to be in Africa anymore, but that doesn't mean there isn't other things there. But it could be a whole rash of things. I mean, it could be anything from, you know, ancient antiquities, things that pertain to these ancient civilizations. There might be a fucking mothership buried under Africa for a while, you know, but resources, that's a big thing. Resources, really eugenics and doing away with certain people and certain bloodlines and wiping them off the face of the planet in the name of industry and growth and expansion. I mean, it's been happening since time immemorial, and we're just living in whatever the modern day versions of this stuff is. And nobody's been able to stop these people yet, but it doesn't mean that there aren't still people who are at least going to try. So, you know, I any things that I might have to say on the whole Africa thing would be speculation, but it is a fact that's always been one of their key assets to control. Just because, I mean, that's why they're setting up AFRICOM and all this stuff over there. I've been working on that for years. But really, it's resources and it's location and everything else. They want to make sure that Western countries gain control of Africa before any Arab nation that's pretty much it, to be honest with you. They want to get it before the Arabs take over it and take it over. The Muslim Brotherhood and all this stuff. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. But the reason that is because they don't want to give, you know, the apparent upper hand to any other countries, because, you know, Africa's is a key domain. But really, it's a continued expansion of the power structure itself. And, the desire to wipe out undesirable people. On top of antiquities and gold and diamonds and, you know, everything else. But, to overlook in all of the political stuff and the resource wars. Because, you know, I mean, that was a couple of years ago. I covered that a couple of years ago. I think it was like 2008 I covered that, 2008, 2009 or something, where it was the Army War College documents, and they were talking about how the coming wars in the next decade would be resource wars, and how if any nation or population, civilian or otherwise, got in the way of these resource wars, that they would be wiped out. So it's definitely apparent that's the big part of it. But just like everything else, genocide, and it's real fun stuff. Thanks, Anderson, for the email. This is from Mark. Mark says, just want to share with you this information. Give me just one second here. Something's supposed to be coming up in this link. I just don't see anything coming up. I'll just read what he wrote. He says, Ron Paul has traded his three separate corporations on Dun & Bradstreet. Well, that's interesting. In fact, look for any one of the current Republican presidential candidates on the site and you will find them. I'm sure you're aware of the fact that the United States is a corporation. The Constitution is not for you, and that therefore we are not subject to it under any of its laws. So all of this NDAA martial law talk is utter nonsense and based on fiction. Yeah, absolutely. I said that since day one. To better understand what I'm talking about, I implore you to watch these videos and visit the YouTube channel. It'd be great if you could get this information out on your next show. People need to know that fear is the quote-unquote elite's greatest weapon. Keep up the excellent work, Mr. Reeves. It's always a pleasure tuning in. Yeah, Operation Dropkick, 12 questions for Ron Paul. Operation Dropkick, the law, fiction, and the fact, BCA to Z, citizen. Okay. Yeah, I'll check that out. Thanks, Mark. I appreciate the email there, buddy. Let's see. That's from Scott. He says, hi, Josh. Wanted to follow up with the email you read last night from Matt. You were talking about how you could get access to a much larger audience if you could get your films up on Netflix or iTunes. I understand that those are big outlets with access to big audiences, but when you have something as big as Netflix or iTunes, would you even get noticed? I mean, would you get lost in a huge sea of other films? I don't know if this is true or not, but I heard somebody talking about if you had a band that was just starting out, you would never get noticed on iTunes. You'd be drowned out by so many other bands. I don't know if you can compare music to films. I just want to get your take on this. Thanks, Scott from Portland. Well, yeah, totally. And I sent Scott an email back, but the totally different ballpark with bands and iTunes. And you're right. There's a gazillion bands out there, and it's very easy for any one of those gazillion bands to get their music on iTunes. Films are totally different because there are less people making films, and it's not as easy as just paying and having it uploaded to iTunes. It has to be approved, and that's very difficult to get, and that's exactly what this service, that's why I needed the 1500 in the first place. I mean, if it was just as easy as, uploading your MP3s to iTunes, like getting music and having a band is, I would have had it up there a long time ago. And I wouldn't have felt as compelled to want to get that done and have the money to do that. But because films are totally different, and because when you go and look at Netflix and iTunes, if you're a regular user of those, I have, family and friends and roommates who are regular users of Netflix, so I see it all the time. And I'm a pretty regular user of iTunes, so what's updated and what's new on those things is really few and far between. You might get 10 or 20 things maybe a week that are new, whereas in music you might get 10,000 in one day. So people who are regular users of these services eventually after a while start to have gone through and seen most everything that's up there. So that makes a great advantage for a film like mine, because when they're scrolling through, oh, I've seen this, they're looking for something they haven't seen, because there's so much, so little that gets updated very often, that gives me a tremendous opportunity to be, something that people who maybe had never, ever, would ever check out my film any other way. It's going to give the ability to get people to kind of accidentally fall on top of it and find it. And I think that's opening up those, those things that I talked about last week about how your information finds you when it's supposed to find you. But I really would like to have the opportunity for it to be able to find more of those people it's supposed to find. So, yeah, I mean, it's really apples and oranges when you're talking about music and video, they have a stringent policy about getting them up there, but that's what this company Distributor does. You pay them the money, and not only do they guarantee that they get it up there, they also get it up there for you with zero royalties. You get 100% of your royalties back for everything you sell. So thanks for the email there, Scott. Appreciate that. This guy, Ben Kirby. Hey, dude, I don't know if you're listening to the shows or not. You sent me this goddamn email last week about Tosh.0, whatever it was. I read that whole email on the show last week. You sent it to me again. Go listen to the show. Geez Louise. I mean, it drives me crazy when people do that. And I know they're listening because they'll say stuff in their emails that lets me know they're listening. You skip that show or something, bud. I got your email. I'm aware of what you're trying to tell me. I read it on the show. Can't do anything else for you other than that. Sorry. This is from John. John says, hi, Josh. I know what a shill Alex Jones is. Yeah. There's fuck hope so by now. Wish more people did. Now, the other day, I was searching for DeGen videos. Oh, the Jen? You're talking, the Jen are genies, by the way. Yeah, that's always been what's been amazing to me about the looting of the Iraq National Museum, where they took all the antiquities pertaining to Akkadia, Sumeria, Babylon, the Ubaid period. You know, these reptilian statues holding human babies up to their tits, and reptilian humanoids wearing Masonic aprons with tablets and stuff like that. We're talking, prior to Sumeria period, the Ubaid period in what is now Iraq. And there's footage from the BBC where they show the Special Forces going in and breaking open the vault. And when they break open the vault, inside of this vault, inside the Iraq National Museum, there are just literally thousands, floor to ceiling, thousands of these gin bottles. Not gin bottles like, I got me some Seagram's gin. My homie's got the cups, but they ain't chipped in. Not that kind of gin. Like the gin. That's how you say it, though, the gin. They're genies. And so some of these dated back to the Babylonian period. And these were placed in there in this vault in the Iraq National Museum because they were said to contain these spirits or these entities where our stories of genies and the genie in the bottle and all that stuff come from. That's what the djinn is. It's the genie in the bottle. I always thought that was always such a strange correlation, in that 1960s TV show. It always made me wonder, if maybe that was kind of based on some actual facts or something, with I Dream a Genie, because you had Larry Hagman, and he was a NASA astronaut. I mean, how weird is that? He's a NASA astronaut that finds a genie bottle, and it happens to have this, hot-ass genie in it. And, he's trying to keep it a secret from everybody. And I always wondered, I wonder if that's a real, did that really happen? I mean, did some fucking NASA employee find a DeGen bottle somewhere and open it up and let a genie out? They made some quirky sitcom about it. That way, if anybody ever, eventually found out about it, they go, oh, that's a lie. I'd never believe that. That just sounds like I Dream a Genie. You know what I mean? They love doing that kind of stuff. Now, the other day, I was searching for DeGen videos on YouTube, and I found this interview with Sean Stone. Oh, yeah, the son of Oliver Stone, the guy who's making who's going to Iran to make a video about Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. I mean, these guys love hanging out with these commie Timpok dictators, don't they? He said he went to Iran to accept Islam, but more importantly he went to Iran to accept Islam? Man, I tell you what, I've had my suspicions about Oliver Stone for a long time. I've heard all kinds of stuff. He's under mind control, that he's, that he's a Freemason, that he's a Knight of Malta, all kinds of stuff. I don't know. That's interesting. I mean, you definitely see all kinds of connections with him to priest class stuff. And, the fact that he made JFK and he had Woody Harrelson in Natural Born Killers and, Woody Harrelson's dad being connected to the Kennedy assassination. Yeah. Now I have been to Iran, and these guys are very hard to find. What do you mean, these guys? He went to Iran to accept Islam, but more importantly, to meet the DeGen masters. What do you mean, the DeGen masters? I mean, these are like genies in the bottle. How does one go and meet the DeGen masters? I've never heard of that. I don't know what the djinn masters are. Are they ones that can actually talk to these spirits in these bottles? I don't have any idea what that is, John. I'm sorry, I've never heard of that. I know what the djinn are. I know they're these entities and these spirits in the genie bottles, but I don't know anything about DeGen masters. I thought DeGen masters were the ones inside of the bottles. How you could go there and find them? So you're telling me that Sean Stone, Oliver Stone's son, has gone to Iran to try and find the fucking genie in the bottle. That's wild. Well, it would really kind of confirm those suspicions of those things people have said about him being a priest class minion bozo, or both the Stones being priest class minion bozos. I mean, didn't he make a film? Oliver Stone made a film where he went to, he's hanging out with Hugo Chavez. Now he's going to hang out with Dinner Jacket. Oh, dude, Akhenaten on a dinner jacket. Now I've been to Iran. These guys are very hard to find. It's funny as Alex keeps trying to cut him off when he starts talking about the Star of David and how the Jinns can be controlled. So what's your take on this? Oh, no, it's not even my take, dude. I got that pinned for you fucking 8 ways to Sunday. Now that's a good catch. So I guess I'm taking from this that Alex Jones actually interviewed Sean Stone about this. Now that's interesting. And so now I haven't listened to this myself, but John does have the video clip here, so I'll check it out later. That apparently Sean Stone starts saying that you can use the Star of David to control the jinns, the genies. And what's interesting about that is that, oh my goodness, and Jones keeps cutting him off. Oh man, that's gold. I got to hear that because that, I mean, yeah, you're right, John. I mean, that totally is another, with him trying to cover up. Because if you know what that is, and I'll explain it to you, if you know what the implications of that are, then you know that is 100% Alex Jones doing his regular shtick. And anytime anybody starts getting too close to the deeper information the priest class wants to keep hidden, he starts to cover it up and starts talking over people and doesn't let them get it out. But that goes back to King Solomon. Because what people call the Star of David is actually more appropriately called the Hermetic Seal of Solomon. Now, it's said that there were laser-etched seals of Solomon within the walls of Solomon's temple, produced by some advanced, presumably alien technology that supposedly worked in conjunction with the Ark of the Covenant and, of course, Solomon's ring and all that stuff. Now, it is an absolute uncontended fact that King Solomon, his symbol, the Hermetic Seal of Solomon, was used in combination with the Book of the Goetia to summon and conjure 37 different angels and demons that he would conjure and then capture and hold inside of a device, presumably, again, the Ark of the Covenant, that could then be used and controlled. Now, the Goetia gives you the ability to conjure up these different demons, and it's kind of like making a stew, Put a little dash of this in here, put a little dash of that in there, and if you're a high-level magi and you know what you're doing, you know how to be able to combine the right amounts of these various different entities, some demonic, some angelic, and combine them in the right mixture together where you can hold them. You remember the ecto-containment units in Ghostbusters? Next time you get a chance, go look at those watch Ghostbusters and watch how the ecto-containment units open up. And they open up with the sign that there's just pure light emanating out of it, and they suck the entities down into it, it closes up. And then go and watch Raiders of the Lost Ark and watch the end part, fast forward to the end part when they're doing an actual Kabbalistic ritual. I mean, Spielberg didn't just get that right on accident. Okay, the guy had a fucking ephod chest plate on. He was saying the Kabbalistic phrases. I mean, that was legit stuff in there. And you see it opening up, and of course all the entities come out of it. They're flying around everywhere, and they kill all the Nazis, and Indy's saying, "Don't look, don't look," Well, that's essentially what King Solomon had the ability to do. He was such a high-level magi, and he apparently had this information that, of course, came down from what we've been reading with Sitch and stuff, apparently from the Anunnaki and the rest of that. And he was able, through these, through the use of the Hermetic Seal of Solomon, to control various entities and then contain them and use them for his purposes. So I find that highly interesting. And it would seem to me, you know, people have said that Oliver Stone is a CIA agent. And that would be interesting, too, because like father, like son, it very well could be that his son, Sean Stone, is a CIA agent or an agent of the priest class itself, which is what the CIA is. All the guys who set up the CIA that came out of the OSS, all these guys were all Knights of Malta all the way across the board. And it could be that he's going to Iran to, you know, accept Islam and, you know, make this, apparently the cover story is he was going to go accept Islam and make a documentary about Mahmoud on a dinner jacket. And but that's the cover story. But really what he's going to be going to do is figuring out how to, because if he said, I mean, if he literally started talking about using the Star of David to control the djinn and Alex started cutting him off, that's huge. I mean, I haven't heard this yet, so I can't confirm it, but that's what John's saying here. I don't think he'd have any reason to make it up, considering he sent me the link. But, you know, that's huge, because that tells us right there that Sean Stone knows about King Solomon and the ability to control and conjure these entities using that symbol. That's, wow. Well, I guess we figured out why they've been beating the Iran war drums now, have we? It's not about the nuclear stuff, but I figured that out several years ago. I figured that out in like 2008, when I found out the Behistun inscription was there, the big rock with, you know, that's signed at the bottom, signed, inscribed to Zeus from Queen Semiramis. I shit you not. Big wing disc, King Darius thing on it, yeah. But that's what it is. They got the gin bottles with the genies in them out of the Iraq National Museum. Now they need to complete their collection, or they're looking. See what they're doing is, I think, John, is they're looking for the different contents of their soup, and these contents of this soup of these various entities are scattered in various places throughout the world. And most of all, along the countries in the Middle East of what was ancient Mesopotamia, Iraq, Iran, the whole area. And so it does appear, and this could tie in with the whole, you know, taking over of Jerusalem and through the rebuilding of the temple and the landing pad. I think that what they're doing is, and why they've been going to all these different places, is they're trying to find the various gin bottles that have these entities and these creatures in them that have been buried in museums and in, you know, places where are considered holy so outsiders can't come in. And that's what these religious laws for years have been set up in these different countries to do. So it seems that, yes, they are on the hunt, and that could be what, that could answer the question of what they're looking for in Africa as well. They are looking for the rest of these spirits to combine them and put them together. You know what that means then, don't you? That means they must have already found the Ark of the Covenant. Maybe that's why they allegedly went and blew up the moon, because as it talks about in these Sumerian texts of Enki and Ninurta going to the moon and taking with them the power supply for the bond to heaven and earth, the Stargate. And of course, we know with NASA, we know now why there was why they really hoaxed the moon landing. All these conspiracy theories claiming they've told the truth about it all these years. No, the real truth of why they did it is because they performed on the first moon landing that took place in a studio, but to the rest of the eyes of the rest of the world, really happened. They performed a Masonic ritual. The picture of this is actually in the Grand Lodge of the 33rd in Washington, D.C., by the way. And they performed a ritual in which they declared the moon to be the sovereign property of the titular head of all world Freemasonry. So they declared the moon the property of Freemasonry. Why would they do this? They did it because their ancestors, who were the forefathers that went to Scotland and created Masonry, were the Templars. And the Templars, after excavating Solomon's Temple, had gained for a time this power of the Goetia and this power of the use of the Hermetic Seal of Solomon, and became very powerful for it. And that's when the priest class had them executed and had their information taken. And that is single-handedly when we started to live on this planet under the dark forces and demonic forces of the possibilities of this dimension. We've been living under it ever since then. So thanks for the email there, John. Wow. Crazy stuff. Yeah, they're definitely going after these entities, man. They want to start using them together, and I mean it's happening. They've you know, again, that's why they faked the whole moon thing to declare the moon the property of that, so they can take it back over for their people. That way, when they find the Ark of the Covenant there, they can say, "Oh, well, that belongs to us because we declared it for Freemasonry." Well, I think they've already found it. I think they've had it for some period of time. Well, that's all the emails we have tonight. Thanks for everybody for sending those in. Woolly mammoth could walk again as Russians agree to ship Siberian remains to Korean cloning scientists. Now, you know, I'm still fail to see the advantage of, cloning a woolly mammoth. I mean, are we going to make mammoth burgers? Are we going to feed starving kids in Africa with mammoth meat, cloned mammoth meat? What are we going to do here? I don't know, man. I guess I've just seen Jurassic Park too many times. It should just seems to me it's not a good idea, you know? Dennis to probe cavities inside Great Pyramid and unlock the Pharaoh's last secret chamber unseen for 4,500 years. And, of course, this is the chamber that Thoth claims in the Emerald Tablets of Thoth to have left the keys on how to enter the halls of Amenti. A Hong Kong dentist is wielding forceps to help solve the last mystery of the Great Pyramid of Giza. He's a part of a team that hopes to solve the mystery surrounding the doors blocking two narrow shafts in the pyramid, which is the tomb of the pharaoh Cheops, also known as Khufu. The shafts have puzzled archaeologists since they were found in 1872, with some speculating that Khufu's burial chamber lies beyond with fabulous treasury. God, these terrible, terrible writers. Fabulous treasure possibly within. Ningzi Chuan, 59, has designed a tiny gripper for an insect-sized robot which will finally reach beyond the doors inside the pyramid. The robot will travel up the shafts, which are so narrow only a small robot could fit, to eventually drill through the two doors. It carries a camera to record what it finds. The international team, which take the name the Jedi, after the magician with whom Khufu is thought to have consulted for the pyramid layout. Yeah, the Jedi. That's like where the Jedi Knights came from. The Jedi, the Djinn. The Jedis had the ability to communicate with the Djinn, as we were talking about earlier. There you go. Synchronicity abounding. Yet again, my God, it happens every show, doesn't it? Oh, man. Plans to use this robot this spring, depending on when the license to do so will be issued. The Chinese have more experience with chopsticks, and a dentist has more experience in gripping with forceps. Why Egypt is so interesting is because of all of the hieroglyphs. It's like a detective story. It's all waiting for me to use my grippers. And, of course, this is also where it has that stone. We talked about this a few months ago. They were talking about doing this, but they have a stone there, and the stones have very similar writing on them as to some of the stones that were found at the rock wall dig site. So that makes that all the more interesting. Let's see what else we have here. Marines change recruiting pitch to include humanitarian missions. After a decade of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Marine Corps is tweaking its recruiting pitch to emphasize not just combat prowess, but also the Marines' involvement in humanitarian missions. Oh, so we're all about going and feeding the children. Join the Marines. We're not about killing. We're about going and saving the children. Bullshit. My ass. First to fight, first to die, first to kill. Marines. Hoorah. Give me a break. I mean, seriously. That's false advertising. You only go into the Marines to kill, maim, and destroy. Not to go pat puppies on the head and be nice and, you know, put flowers in the ends of guns. Give me a fucking break. Nobody's going to buy that. Everybody knows what the Marines are. If you want to put flowers in the ends of guns, go join the fucking Peace Corps or, you know, the Navy or something. Oh, man. That's straight out of the military PSYOP stuff that Paul Vallely, head of a senior military analyst at Fox News. He was head of the Army's psych warfare stuff. He wrote the Mind War documents, of course, with Michael Aquino. And that's, you know, Michael Aquino's, well, they were responsible for all that, you know, the stuff in Men Who Stare at Goats, all the non-lethal combat stuff. I mean, so yeah, that tells you right there that's coming right out of the Army PSYOPs manual. I watched this documentary recently, and it was called The Cave of Forgotten Dreams. It was by Werner Herzog. And I was interested in watching this documentary because it shows these cave paintings done in these caves that were found by accident in France. And they depict animals and humans, and you know, there's human handprints and stuff in there. We're talking about pre-Ice Age here. And it's amazing how many... I'll get into that later. I'll get into that later. I don't want to get into that tangent right now. I'll get into that in a bit. Let me get back on this. It pertains to this, but I don't want to get into that yet. There's just been a lot of synchronicities lately with a lot of things coming out, a lot of news stories, and a lot of supposed new findings that seem to be pushing the date of humans and the date of human activity on the planet back and back and back. And I just find it too coincidental that there, I mean, every day now I'm seeing stories about this. And it just reminds, you know, the same kind of thing happened when I was doing Seek Right Volume 2. Right after Volume 1 came out, it was like, you know, Oberman and or this show over here or this news, you know, newspaper over here is talking about the CMP or whoever. And it just seemed to me, I started getting the impression, I'm like, these motherfuckers know what's coming, don't they? They know what I'm about to drop on. They know I got the goods. And so what they're doing is I'm starting getting the sneaking impression that they were preemptively allowing a lot of the CMP stuff to be brought out so that it lessened the blow for the question of, you know, how come you guys aren't fucking talking about the CMP? So it seemed to me that they were like, you know, Jonesy was starting to have guests on to, you know, asking them about it. It seemed to me that there was this damage control thing going on. So they started running more news stories and more articles about it and more stuff on TV where they would mention it because they were trying to, you know, make it appear that they had been talking about it for years. And, oh, anybody that says there's been a blackout on the information is full of shit. Well, you know, I didn't really say anything or get up here and talk about that on the show when that was happening. But now, as I'm working on this rock wall stuff, and more we start to find out, you know, just how old these structures are. You know, we're talking 500 million years old here. And it just seems that ever since I started to work on this rock wall film, all of a sudden, we're starting to see more and more of these dates pushed farther and farther back as if they're trying to preemptively roll out information they've known about for years about how old stuff is so that when this Rock Wall film comes out and the evidence that I'm going to show in this film comes out, it softens the blow for the questions that people are going to have as to how come we haven't been told how old things really are and how long there's been some kind of activity by human-type people on this planet for way longer than they've ever told us. And I think that's definitely going on now. And this film, The Cave of Forgotten Dreams, I kept feeling when I was watching this like I wasn't getting the whole picture. I wasn't getting the, I mean, Werner Herzog, I guess I should have known there, right? But I kept getting the feeling because I kept seeing things that they seemed to, that the camera seemed to blow past really fast. And again, synchronistically, here's this article. Previously overlooked patterns in the art of southern France and Spain suggest man might have learned written communication 25,000 years earlier than we thought. Visit the caves of Pec Merlet, Font de Gomme, and Ruffaniac in southern France, and you will witness some of the most breathtaking art our planet has to offer. Images of bisons, lions, and other creatures loom from the cavern walls, herds of horses and the occasional rhino, not to mention the old mammoth and the odd mammoth and giant bull. They parade across the rocks. Many animals are depicted in vivid colors with a sense of perspective and anatomical detail that suggests that these artists had acquired considerable skill. These underground galleries, found mostly in France and Spain, also turn out to be remarkably old. The works at Ruffaniac have been dated to around 13 years old, while those at nearby Chauvet and Lascaux are thought to be more than 30,000 years old. This testimony on rock walls in daubs of ochre and charcoal mixed with spittle and fat shows that our hunter-gatherer ancestors could depict the world around them in a startlingly sophisticated way. As the art critic John Berger once said of these painters, they appear to have had grace from the start. Grace from the start. They didn't have to, you know, learn it. Yeah, genetic manipulation. Picasso was even more awestruck. We have invented nothing, he remarked gloomily after a visit to Lascaux in 1940 to inspect the handiwork of his Stone Age predecessors. Not surprisingly, these paintings attract tens of thousands of visitors every year. However, there's another aspect to this art that often escapes attention, but which is now providing scientists with fresh insights into our recent evolution. Instead of studying those magnificent galloping horses and bisons, researchers are investigating the symbols painted beside them. These signs are rarely mentioned in most studies of ancient cave art. Some are gathered in groups, some appear in ones or twos, while others are mixed in with the cave's images of animals. There are triangles, squares, full circles, semicircles, open angles, crosses, and groups of dots. Others are more complex, drawing of hands with distorted fingers, known as negative hands. Rows of parallel lines, diagrams of branch-like symbols, known as pinniforms, or little sketches of hut-like entities called tectiforms. In total, 26 specific signs are used repeatedly in these caves, created in the millennium when Europe descended into and emerged from the last great ice age. These symbols are all over these cave walls, but no one really notices them, says Genevieve von Petzinger of the University of Victoria in British Columbia. For example, in Werner Herzog's recent documentary about Chauvet, The Cave of Forgotten Dreams, he concentrates totally on the paintings of the horses and rhinos and lets his camera sweep past the symbols as if they simply are not there. That's amazing, because that's exactly what I got when I watched that film. I mean, it was, you know, it was a beautiful film. It was a high def, and seeing the symbol, the paintings and stuff themselves, it was breathtaking. But I just, you know, I walked away from watching it as feeling as if I was being, you know, just the old distractionary thing. Look over here. Look at this over here. But don't look over here. That is a mistake, according to von Petzinger. For the symbols provide clear evidence of the way our ancestors moved from representing ideas realistically, as in those beautiful images of bisons and mammoths, to the stage where they began to represent concepts symbolically. In some cases, signs appear to emerge from the use of truncated images of an animal and eventually come to act as a symbol for that animal in its entirety. For example, a wavy line used to depict the back of a horse in a larger painting eventually comes to stand for the entire horse in different sets of paintings. Yeah, that's amazing. Well, another thing, there was a couple of things he dropped in there in that film that were odd to me. Like, it made me think that there was some time traveler shit going on with this. If you haven't seen that film, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, watch it so you can reference what I'm talking about here. They literally say in that documentary that they know that these paintings were done by the same person because he left his handprints on various locations underneath the paintings. But what they can't explain is that some of the paintings in the cave were done 5,000 years apart from each other. Now, I was like, Hold on. I heard that wrong, right? Let me back that shit up. You know, I heard that shit wrong. Nope, that's what they said. They know for a fact they were done by the same person. What they can't explain, and they just say that shit. They just drop that shit on you and move on like it's nothing. Like it's nothing to even think about. Wait a minute, wait. You know it was done by the same person? But yet, they were done 5,000 years apart from each other? I'd say that's a pretty damn good question we need to ask here. So, yeah, it makes total sense that Herzog would be covering this up. But there is more to von Petzinger's work than the study appearance of the symbols. Working with her colleague April Knoll, she has created a database of all the signs found in more than 200 caves and other shelters in France and Spain. This is unbelievable. So who was this person who did this? I mean, you know, were they immortal? Were they locked in this cave because they couldn't die? I don't know. That's interesting, but definitely watch that film and you'll be able to pick through the bullshit, but it's definitely worth seeing. Like I said, you just have to, you got to wade through the horse shit to get there. Let's see what else we have here. Mysterious fossils of what may be a previously unknown type of human. Oh, man. Anunnaki. Have been discovered in caves in China. Ones that possess a highly unusual mix of bygone and modern human features. It's a genetic hybrid. Old human features and new modern human features put together in one, yeah. I mean, this probably explains why they have all those pyramids in China that they won't let anybody excavate or do anything to at all. Surprisingly, the fossils are only between 11,500 and 14,500 years old. That means they would have shared the modern landscape with modern humans, when China's earliest farmers were first appearing. These new fossils might be of a previously unknown species, one that survived until the very end of the Ice Age around 11,000 years ago. Alternatively, they might represent a very early and previously unknown migration of modern humans out of Africa, a population who may not have contributed genetically to living people. At least three fossil specimens were uncovered in 1989 by miners quarrying limestone at Modong and Red Deer Cave near the city of Mengzi in southwest China. They remained unstudied until 2008. The scientists are calling them the Red Deer Cave People, because they cooked extinct red deer in their namesake cave. They clearly had a taste for venison, with evidence they cooked these large deer in the cave. Carbon dating, a technique that estimates the radioactive decay of carbon in samples or charcoal, found that the fossils helped establish their age. The charcoal also showed that they knew how to use fire. Stone artifacts found at the Maldong site also suggest they were tool makers. A Chinese geologist found a fourth partial skeleton, which looks very similar to the Molodong fossils, in a cave near the village of Longlin in southwest China in 1979 while prospecting the area for oil. It stayed encased in a block of rock, neglected in the basement of an archaeological research institute until 2009, when the international team of scientists rediscovered the fossils. In 2009, when I was in China working with co-author Professor Xing Suping, he showed me the block of rock that contained the skull. After picking my own jaw up from the floor, we decided we had to make the remains a priority of our research. The Stone Age fossils are unusual mosaics of modern and archaic human anatomical features, as well as previously unseen characteristics. This makes them difficult to classify as either a new species or an unusual type of modern human. Well, I think the reason they don't want to answer that is because it appears. I mean, have you seen the image of what this thing looks like? I mean, it looks like somebody from Africa. I mean, it looks like a black man. I dropped a link to the picture there in the chat room, but you know, this also could very well represent some kind of one of the early slave race people that they had built that the Anunnaki had built to do the work for them, and you know, they may not want this being drug up. That's for sure. Plastic surgeon under investigation after commissioning music video encouraging Jewish boy Jukan Sam to get a nose job. Jukan Sam? Hey, it's Jukan Sam! That is filth. A plastic surgeon is coming under fire after he commissioned a song and music video which encourages plastic surgery for a character whose name is described as resembling a beak like Jukan Sam. Dr. Michael Salzhauer of Bal Harbour Plastic Surgery in Miami thought it would be funny to commission the Groggers, a self-professed Jewish pop punk band with a comic twist, to make a music video entitled The Nose Job Love Song. The American Society of Plastic Surgeons has expressed their disgust and released a statement saying it was initiated with an investigation under its code. He had a Jew nose. I mean, my God. You ever seen some of those Hebrew hammers before? I mean, some of them motherfuckers do need some goddamn nose jobs. I mean, let's be real here. That's not insensitive or racially biased. Some of them motherfucking Jews got some big motherfucking noses. Jukan Sam, I mean, my God, have you ever seen fucking Sarah Jessica Parker's nose? Tell me that ain't Jukan Sam. Jesus. Ugh, kill it before it breathes. That's just fucking hilarious. Conspiracy theories claim mysterious planet-sized Death Star has been captured on video as it refuels at the surface of the sun. Now, isn't that interesting? We were just recently talking about the Nibiru crazies are going nuts over this, because we've been talking about the idea of these planets and even Nibiru being, you know, like a Death Star, a ship-type thing. And, people are freaking out over this one. And Orbit, of course, they're running all kinds of damage control against it and saying they have a natural explanation for it. And maybe they do, and maybe it is a natural phenomenon. But I just love how every time that there's something like this and happens that makes people jump all over it and say, you know, it's this or that. Every time the scientific community comes back and says, no, you're wrong, it's this, we know what it is, it's this, then they can't produce another one like it. They can never do that. I love how they do that. Just like the rock wall. Oh, it's natural, but we've never found another one like it anywhere else in the world. So how do you know it's natural if you've never found another one like it? Well, we just know, because we're scientists and we know best. Wait, we went to college. We have degrees. Same thing here. Oh, this is not the Death Star, or this is not Nibiru, this is not anything anomalous. This is just natural sun things. That's what the sun does. It's a sun tornado. Well, show us another picture of a phenomenon just like this one, this picture. Well, we don't have any, but it's natural. Go back to sleep. An orbiting NASA space telescope captured a dark planet-sized object flying close to the sun on Monday and extending what looks like a refueling tube into the star's surface. The black Death Star-like orb is briefly engulfed in light from the sun, then flies off into space. A video edited from the Solar Dynamics Observatory photos inspired a wave of speculation on YouTube. The imagery was captured by NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory and edited together by YouTube user Sunsflare, who challenged experts to explain the strange visitor. Naturally, the space agency has a rather more ordinary explanation for the strange black orb. It's not a visitor from another solar system or a planet being born out of the surface of the sun, as others had speculated. Instead, it's a solar prominence or filament, a feature extending from out of the sun, which forms over the course of a day. and can extend hundreds of thousands of miles into space. Scientists are still puzzled as to why these features form. The dark parts are material cooler than the surrounding solar matter. See Alex Young, a solar astrophysicist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, said in a reply to Sunflare's video, filaments appear to be dark because they're cooler in relation to what's in the background. When you look at it from the edge of the sun, what you see is this spherical object, and you're actually looking down a tunnel. So, of course, they're, you know, very quick to say, we know what this is, we know what this is, it's natural, but, you know, we don't have another example of it, so fuck off. Oh, man, that's rich. That is rich. That's pretty much all the news we got tonight, man. Not a lot. I almost didn't even do a show tonight, so that's why we started things a little later tonight. We are going to take a break, come back, and we're going to get into the end of days from Zachariah Sitchin tonight. We're going to continue the chapter we left off at last night. We have the stream coming up due tomorrow, folks. We have a long way to go on our chipping banner, and we need to get a lot more support in here so we can meet that goal. And we got a long way to go on the rock wall dig fund as well. If you can help us out with it, any of those projects, please go to theglobalreality.com. Use either one of the chipping banners there. You can use the donate buttons. You can use my direct PayPal email address and send it as you know, a personal thing, so there's no fees. dayglow76@yahoo.com, dayglow76@yahoo.com. You can do it that way. We have a P.O. box there as well. Just please support our work so we can stay alive and pay the bills and keep going and get this work done. This is The Global Reality. Stay with us.
We'll be right back.
uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
All right, back here with you on the Global Reality, right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being with us tonight for another late night Moonbat edition of the broadcast. My website where this broadcast originates from is theglobalreality.com. That's theglobalreality.com. And you can get my newest documentary film on DVD or Blu-ray. If you haven't got a copy of that yet, you owe it to yourself and your friends and family to get a copy of that film so you can get some really good information, especially with Volume 1 and Volume 2, that you need to be concerned about with alleged truth tellers and the rest of this whole deal. So please get copies of that film, and if you already have one, buy another one, give it to somebody as a gift or hand it out, you know, do whatever. And also we have the Chiffin banner there, and we're about halfway through the month, and we have a long way to go on the Chiffin banner, so we really need some help on that to make sure that we all need to pay the bills and survive. It's only raised $163 for the month, that it be the 15th of the month. That's terrible. It's just appalling, but you know, it doesn't do any good to yell and scream about it. And I shouldn't have to get my blood pressure up about it because, I mean, you know, you either value what I do or you don't. That's just all there is to it. So there you go. And also we have the Rockwall film budget, which we love to have your support on as well. There you go. Let's get into the end of days for you here tonight. The Ptolemies, having managed to maneuver Alexander's body for burial in Egypt, consider themselves his true heirs and by and large continued his tolerant attitude towards other religions. They established the famed library at Alexandria and assigned an Egyptian priest known as Manetho to write down Egypt's dynastic history and divine prehistory for Greeks that convinced the Ptolemies that their civilization was a continuation of the Egyptian one, and they thus considered themselves rightful successors to the pharaohs. Greek savants showed their particular interest in the religion and writings of the Jews, so much so that the Ptolemies arranged for the translation of the Hebrew Bible into Greek and allowed the Jews complete religious freedom of worship in Judea as well as in their growing communities in Egypt. Like the Ptolemies, the Seleucids also retained a Greek-speaking scholar, a former priest of Marduk known as Berossus, to compile for them the history and prehistory of mankind and its gods according to Mesopotamian knowledge. In a twist of history, he researched and wrote at a library of cuneiform tablets located near Haran. It is from his three books, which we now know of only from fragmented quotations in the writings of others in antiquity, that the Western world of Greece, then Rome, learnt of the Anunnaki and their coming to Earth, the pre-diluvial era, the creation of wise man, the deluge, and what followed. Thus, it was from Berossus, as later confirmed by the discovery and decipherment of the cuneiform tablets, that the 3600 SAR, as the year of the gods, was first learned. In 200 BCE, the Seleucids crossed the Potomac boundary and captured Judea. In other instances, historians have searched for geopolitical and economic reasons for the war, ignoring the religious messianic aspects. It was in the report about the deluge that the tidbit information was given by Berossus that Ea and Enki, or Ea, who is also Enki, instructed Zisudra, the Sumerian Noah, to conceal every available writing in Sippar, the city of Shamash, for post-diluvial recovery, because those writings were about beginnings, middles, and ends. According to Berossus, the world undergoes periodic cataclysms, and he related them to the zodiacal ages. His contemporary one having begun 1,920 years before the Seleucid era, that would have placed the beginning of the age of the ram in 2232 BCE, an age destined to come too soon to an end, even if the full mathematical length is granted to it. The available record suggests that the Seleucid kings, coupling those circulations with the missing return, were seized with the need to urgently expect and prepare for one. A frenzy of rebuilding the ruined temples of Sumer and Akkad begin, with emphasis on E-Anna, the house of Anu in Uruk, the landing place in Lebanon, called by them Heliopolis, city of the sun. God was rededicated by erecting a temple honoring Zeus. The reason for the war to capture Judea, one must conclude, was the urgency of also preparing the space-related science in Jerusalem for the return. It was, we suggest, the Greek Seleucid way of preparing for the reappearance of the gods. Unlike the Ptolemies, the Seleucid rulers were determined to impose the Hellenic culture and religion in their domains. The change was most significant in Jerusalem, where suddenly foreign troops were stationed and the authority of the temple priests was curtailed. Hellenistic culture and customs were forcefully introduced. Even names had to be changed, starting with the high priest, who was obliged to change his name from Joshua to Jason. Civil laws restricted Jewish citizenships in Jerusalem. Taxes were raised to finance the teachings of athletics and wrestling instead of the Torah. And in the countryside, shrines to Greek deities were being erected by the authorities and soldiers who were sent to enforce worship in them. In 169 BCE, the then Seleucid king Antiochus IV, who adopted the epithet Epiphanes, came to Jerusalem, It was not a courtesy visit. Violating the temple's sanctity, he entered the Holy of Holies. On his orders, the temple's treasures and golden ritual objects were confiscated. A Greek governor was put in charge of the city, and a fortress for a permanent garrison of foreign soldiers was built next to the temple. Back in his Syrian capital, Antiochus issued a proclamation requiring worship of Greek gods throughout the kingdom. In Judea, it specifically forbade the observance of the Sabbath and circumcision. In accordance with the decree, the Jerusalem temple was to become a temple to Zeus. And in 167 BCE, on the 25th day of the Hebrew month, Kislev, equivalent to today's December 25th, an idol, a statue representing Zeus, the Lord of Heaven, who was also Enki, was set up by Syrian Greek soldiers in the temple. And the great altar was altered and used for sacrifices to Zeus. The sacrilege could not have been greater. The unavoidable Jewish uprising begun and led by a priest named Mattiyahu and his five sons is known as the Hamashian or the Maccabean Revolt. Starting in the countryside, the uprising quickly overcame the local Greek garrisons. As the Greeks rushed in reinforcements, the revolt engulfed the whole country. What the Maccabees lacked in numbers and weapons, they compensated for by the ferocity of their religious zeal. The events described in the Book of Maccabees and by subsequent historians have no doubt and leave no doubt that the fight of the few against a powerful kingdom was guided by a certain timetable. And I always say that, you know, it seems that these people are on a timetable to find out the, you know, this information or to get these antiquities. They seem to be in a hurry. You know, like the article we read earlier about the robot being sent into the, you know, it just seems like they're on a timetable here. And I've talked about that before. And that's another thing I found in my research, the thing about the timetable, but also what they mentioned before, this whole thing of cataclysms. And I've mentioned that the elite seem to have knowledge of these cataclysms. And so they hide that from us, meanwhile trying to keep us in fear that there are always cataclysms that are going to happen to us but never seem to appear. It was imperative to retake Jerusalem, cleanse the temple, and rededicate it to Yahweh by a certain deadline. Managing in 164 BCE to recapture only the Temple Mount, the Maccabees cleansed the temple and the sacred flame was rekindled that year. The final victory, leading to full control of Jerusalem and restoration of Jewish independence, took place in 160 BCE. The victory and rededication of the temple are still celebrated by Jews as the holiday of Hanukkah, which means rededication on the 25th day of the Kislev. The sequence and the timing of those events appeared to be linked to the prophecies about the end of days. Of those prophecies, as we have seen, the ones that offered specific numerical clues in regard to the ultimate future, the end of days, were conveyed by the angels to Daniel. But clarity is lacking because the counts were enigmatically expressed either in a unit called time or in weeks of years and even in numbers of days, and it is perhaps only in respect to the latter that one is told when the count does begin so that one could know when it would end. In that one instance, the count was to begin from the day when regular offering is abolished and an appalling abomination is set up in the Jerusalem temple. We have established that such an abominable act indeed took place one day in 167 BCE. With a sequence of those events in mind, the count of days given to Daniel must have applied to the specific events at the temple. Its defiling in 167 BCE when the regular offering is abolished and an appalling abomination is set up. The cleansing of the temple in 164 BCE after 1,290 days and Jerusalem's complete liberation by 160 BCE. The numbers of days 1,290 and 1,335 basically match the sequence of events at the temple. According to the prophecies in the book of Daniel, it was then that the clock of the end of days began ticking. The imperative of recapturing the whole city and the removal of uncircumcised foreign soldiers from the Temple Mount by 160 BCE hold the key to another clue. So everybody who's uncircumcised is the unclean, because that's why they did circumcision in the first place, was to make us look more like the Anunnaki, because we had the extra skin fold because of the genetic tinkering. So the reason why they've always called them God's chosen people is because Jews are actually of the Anunnaki. Is that what it is? That makes total sense to me now. That's why they get to be musicians and rock stars and movie stars and all that, and we're just the lowly goy. Yeah, it makes sense now. You know what? Fuck them. That's what I say. Fuck them and feed them fish heads. While we have been using the accepted count of BCE and AD for dating events, the people for those past times obviously could not and did not use a timetable based on a future Christian calendar. The Hebrew calendar, as we have mentioned earlier, was the calendar that began in Nippur in 3760 BCE, and according to that calendar, what we call 160 BCE was precisely the year 3600. That, as the reader knows by now, was a SAR, the original mathematical orbital period of Nibiru, and though Nibiru had reappeared 400 years earlier, the arrival of the SAR year 3600, the completion of one divine year, was of unavoidable significance. To those to whom the biblical prophecies of the return of Yahweh's Kavod to his Temple Mount were unquestioned divine pronouncements, the year we call 160 BCE was a crucial moment of truth. No matter where the planet was, God has promised to return to his temple, and the temple had to be purified and readied for that. That the passage of years according to the Nippurian Hebrew calendar was not lost sight of in those turbulent times is attested by the Book of Jubilees, an extra biblical book presumed to have been written in Hebrew in Jerusalem in the years following the Maccabean Revolt, now available only from its Greek, Latin, Syriac, Ethiopic, and Slavonic translations. It retells the history of the Jewish people from the time of the Exodus in time units of jubilees, the 50-year units decreed by Yahweh at Mount Sinai. It also created a consecutive calendrical historical count that has since became known as Anu Mundi, the year of the world, in Latin, that starts in 3760 BCE, Scholars such as the Reverend R.H. Charles in his English rendition of the book converted such jubilee of years and their weeks to an Ammo Mundi count. That such a calendar was not only kept throughout the ancient Near East, but even determined when events were timed to happen can be ascertained by simply reviewing some pivotal dates, often highlighted in bold font given to our earlier chapters. If we choose just a few of the key historical events, this is what transpires when the BCE is converted to NC, the Nepurian calendar. 0 to 3760, Sumerian civilization, Nepput calendar begins. 3460, the 300, the Tower of Babel incident. 2860 to 900, the Bull of Heaven killed by Gilgamesh. 2360 to 1400, Sargon, the era of Akkad begins. Yeah, this goes on and on and on and on. You can read this yourself, the PDF. I'm not going to go through and read all these dates. Yeah. So I guess when you translate anything to this type of calendar, you start to see events that happened along the dates of this Shar, this orbital cycle of Nibiru. Now, that's interesting. And whether Nibiru is a planet or a ship or a hoax or anything else, it is interesting. The century and a half that elapsed from the Maccabean freeing of Jerusalem to the events connected with Jesus after he arrived, there were some of the most turbulent in the history of the ancient world and of the Jewish people in particular. That crucial period, whose events affect us to this day, began with understandable jubilation. For the first time in centuries, the Jews were again complete masters of their holy capital and sacred temple, free to appoint their own kings and high priests. Though the fighting at the borders continued, the borders themselves now extended to encompass much of the olden United Kingdoms of David's time. The establishment of an independent Jewish state with Jerusalem as its capital under the Hashemians was a triumphal event in all respects except one. The return of Yahweh's Kavod, expected at the end of days, did not take place, even though the count of days from abomination time seemed to have been correct. Was the time of fulfillment not yet at hand, many wondered, and it became evident that the enigmas of Daniel's other counts of years and weeks of years and of time, times, and so on, had yet to be deciphered. Clues were the prophetic parts in the book of Daniel that spoke of the rise and fall of future kingdoms after Babylon, Persia, and Egypt. Kingdoms cryptically called of the south, of the north, or of a seafaring kittim, and kingdoms that shall split off of them, fight each other, plant tabernacles of palaces between the seas, and all future entities that were also cryptically represented by varied animals, a ram, a goat, a lion, and so on, whose offspring, called horns, will again split apart and fight each other. Who were those future nations and what wars were foretold? The prophet Ezekiel also spoke of great battles to come between north and south, between an unidentified Gog and an opposing Magog. That's funny because that's George W. Bush's nickname at the Skull and Bones is Magog. And people were wondering whether the prophesied kingdoms have already appeared on the scene. Alexander's Greece, the Seleucids, the Ptolemies. Were these the subject of the prophecies, or was it someone yet to come in the even more distant future? There was theological turmoil. Was the expectation at the Jerusalem temple of the Kavod as a physical object a correct understanding of prophecies? Or was the expected coming only a symbolic of an ephemeral nature, a spiritual presence? What was required of the people, or was what was destined to happen, will happen no matter what? The Jewish leadership split between devout and by-the-book Pharisees and the more liberal Sadducees were more internationally minded, recognizing the importance of a Jewish diaspora already spread from Egypt to Anatolia to Mesopotamia. In addition to these two mainstreams, small sects, sometimes organized in their own communities, sprang up. The best known of them are the Essenes of the Dead Sea Scrolls fame, who secluded themselves at Qumran. In the effort to decipher the prophecies, a rising new power, Rome, had to be figured in. Having won repeated wars with the Phoenicians and with the Greeks, the Romans controlled the Mediterranean and began to get involved in the affairs of Ptolemaic Egypt and the Seleucid Levant, including Judea. Armies followed imperial delegates, and by 60 BCE, the Romans under Pompey occupied Jerusalem. On the way there, like Alexander before him, he detoured to Helopolis and offered sacrifices to Jupiter. It was followed by the building there atop the earlier colossal stone blocks of the Roman Empire's greatest temple to Jupiter. A commemorative inscription found at the site indicates that the Emperor Nero visited the place in AD 60, suggesting that the Roman temple was already built by then. The national and religious turmoil of these days found expression in a proliferation of the historic prophetic writings, such as the Book of Jubilees, the Book of Enoch, the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs, and the Assumption of Moses, as well as several others, all collectively known as the Apocrypha. The common theme in them was a belief that history is cyclical, that all has been foretold, that the end of days, a time of turmoil and upheaval, will mark not just an end of a historic cycle, but also the beginning of a new one. And that the flip-over time, to use a modern expression, will be manifest by the coming of the Anointed One. Malach in Hebrew, and thus the Messiah or Christ in English. The act of anointing a newly invested king with priestly oil was known in the ancient world, at least from the time of Sargon. It was recognized in the Bible as an act of consecration to God. But its most memorable instance was when the priest Samuel, custodian of the Ark of the Covenant, summoned David, the son of Jesse, and proclaiming him king by the grace of God. And there, and we'll leave it there for tonight, but that's where that divine right to rule comes in. And that's where that divine right to rule comes in. Goes back to that email we talked about from John earlier, the Hermetic Seal of Solomon, the Jinn. They were given the divine right to rule because they had the information that the priests had, which came directly from the gods themselves, the Anunnaki, or whatever you want to call them. And so that's where we see this power, because Solomon had great power and he could have ruled the kingdom any way he wanted to, but he ruled it the way he did, and it was, of course, very tyrannical. But that was that's what this power is, and that's exactly what I found in my research of the secret societies and the secret knowledge, is that the secret knowledge itself that is held by these priest class minions of the Vatican, and in some part, they don't have all of it, but the stuff that's held by the secret societies and the hidden knowledge itself, the information itself is just information. It's just like a gun. It's neutral. A gun is just a gun, but a gun in the hand of someone using it for destructive purposes is bad. It could also be used as a purpose to find food or protect somebody or you know, whatever have you. But what we've seen from the conspiracy genre and the research culture has been, you know, that's devil worship, that's evil, don't look at that, blah, 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 because they want to maintain that only their people learn this knowledge and only use it for the bad. And the fact of the matter is that the information, the knowledge of itself is just knowledge. How it is used is dependent upon the hands of who it falls into. And unfortunately, this knowledge and this power has found itself in the hands of evil men with evil intent and purposes from time immemorial. But the darkness doesn't last forever, and it's time that we come to the forefront and be the light to take back this knowledge and use it for the light and use it for the good, not use it for evil, and use it to free humanity and not to enslave them. And that's the double-edged sword of both knowledge, information, sacred knowledge, and technology. But if we don't want to live under evil, it's time that we start making those steps to reclaim and re-own this information and use it for peaceful purposes. We'll stop right there. I want to thank everybody for tuning in tonight, being here with us for the show. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. Please help us out. We have to pay the stream bill tomorrow. If not, it's going to get cut off, so help us out with the chip-in banner and any amount we can get in, large or small. If we could go ahead and meet the goal, that'd be super fantastic, too. Wouldn't have to worry about it this month. But help us out any way you can, folks. We got a mission here. We got to continue. My name is Josh Reeves. I love each and every one of you. And we will see you next time for the broadcast. You guys have yourselves a great morning, great day. Take care.